Today is November 12th. We are learning the development of Moshe as prophet and leader. And Moshe was originally chosen. When you reach chapter 3, where Moshe asks, "Why me, God? Why are you choosing me? There are lots of people that are better than I am." And he pushes God off 4 times. And when God deals with all 4 of his objections, he just says, "Send someone else." Shlach neviyot tishlach. At which point God gets angry. "Moshe, if you didn't want it to go, then just tell me that first. Don't make up excuses. And when I answer each excuse, then you just say, just no." Right? You understand? That's why charaf at the end. Okay? Rashi on that pasuk says that every time God gets angry in the whole Torah and the whole Tanakh, you see what happens. God doesn't just get angry to get angry. God doesn't actually get angry. If you wish, look up Yirmiyahu chapter 7, verse 19. Okay? He says, "Ho, see, atem machisim, you think you're getting me angry? I don't get angry." Right? Yudak says, "Shelo tachul bimidas kaas velo mida acheres." I don't get angry. You can't describe me, you puny human, with anger. Or any other adjective for that matter. So what does it mean when it says in Tanakh, 1,000 times, Vayicharaf Hashem? Right? So, that means that there is a function, there's something happening that demonstrates a displeasure with God, of God. Okay, that function must always be clear. But it's not in this case when God gets angry with Moshe for pushing off his mission. So Rashi says that, well, there actually is. Hashem tells Moshe, "Moshe, stop with the objections. Your brother Aaron is already on the way. This is done. It's a fait accompli. You have no choice in the matter." Okay? Right? Yes, Moshe could have just taken a head-first dive off the mountain and say, "Oh God, I do have a choice. I'm gonna end it right here." You know what I'm saying? God tells Moshe, listen, we can talk here for a week, we can talk here for 2 weeks, we can talk here for 4 weeks. You're doing it. And your brother's already on the way, so don't worry about it. So that's really what Moshe just goes at this point. He could have just said, "No, shlach neviyot tishlach." I say again, this shows, and this we talked about this in the beginning of the semester, that Moshe's main concern at this time was how will this be accepted by Aaron? Right? Because Moshe has stayed gracious up in front of him with Cain and Abel and his Yitzchak and Yishmael and Yaakov and Esav and Yosef and his brothers and Ephraim and Manasseh and all these older brothers, younger brothers, stuff. Right? So when Hashem tells Moshe, "Listen, Aaron's already on his way, and he's happy for you," why is that part of the debate? Why is that part of the discussion? If not to show that that's what Moshe was worried about. When Hashem covers that, okay, God, I'm in. Right? But Hashem mentions Aaron with an appellation. He says, "Your brother Aaron, blank." Remember what that is? "Your brother Aaron, the blank, is on his way to meet you." Halevi, it says. "Your brother Aaron Halevi, Kachabas God." I know what tribe we're from. Okay, that's the famous medrash that Rashi cites that says, "Moshe, this is the function. You are supposed to be not only the religious leader, but also the spiritual leader." Remember we talked about the difference between these two? You were supposed to be the religious leader as well as the spiritual leader. What's the difference between these two? The difference between these two will go a long way in explaining who is actually the main focus of Korach's revolt. Right? Who is the main focus? You know, no doubt he's questioning Moshe's leadership. But in the end, you can read the story and you see that the main focus is the Kohen. Why are you ingratiating the Kohanim so much, your brother and his children, over the rest of us Levites? Okay, it's a debate regarding the Kahuna, right? And the Kahuna is largely ceremonial. Would you say, right? It was meant to be also instructive. Right? Okay,
Get it? V'chol asher yoru esem. Kohanim are your teachers. Right? Kohanim are your to be sure, your spiritual guides, but Moshe and the Levim are, many more of them, of course, are the teachers and the religious guides, where the Kohanim are standing, a few of them at the head. Okay. But the Hashem tells Moshe, Aaron HaLevi is coming out to meet you. You were supposed to be Kohen. He was supposed to be, his son was supposed to be Levim. You were supposed to take the Kehuna, and now I'm switching that because of all your objections. All right, that's Rashi. Let's get back to our point here, is that when Moshe is so clear about so many different reasons why he can't do this, I submit to you that's his humility. Right? Man, that's one of our chapters here, Bamidbar chapter 12. It's Moshe's humility. Why does that only come out when its discussion is who he's married to? Right? Remember that? So we said back then that's because it had Miriam known how different her brother is than she is, or than Aaron is, she wouldn't have spoken that way about Moshe's wife. Okay, I'm reviewing now a lot of what we did in the past. Okay? It's precisely because he was such an unav that she wouldn't know about Moshe's prophetic ability to wonder what makes him so high on his horse to reject his wife, right? Which is what we did in the last class about when he finally meets his father-in-law after all this time. There's no reference to his reunion with his wife. I remind you what we did last week. He seems to be estranged of his wife when he back in the beginning of Yisrael. It may not be the way of the Bible to actually record a reunion between husband and wife who have been haven't seen each other in a year or two, right? But it fits with Chazal, and Miriam speaks against her brother that he should pay attention to his wife the way you'd pay attention to your wife, Aaron, and the way my husband pays attention to me. I'm a prophet too, and I maintain marital functions. Right? So, but they didn't realize Moshe was such an unov, that's why they could even consider speaking against him. Okay? So that's number 8, Moshe's humility. Okay, you see that? We went through that. Okay. And okay, we did Mei Meriva, right? Number 10. Okay. So what we have here are, what we're going to do is some of the challenges to Moshe. Okay, this is week 4 and week 6, right? Topic 4 and topic 6. Challenges to Moshe, there are 5 of them there. And the Egel, Moshe intercedes for Bnei Yisrael. Okay, so let's go. You have your Shmoses here. And let's read first Shmos Perek Yudalet. Okay, this is before Kriyas Yamsuf. Okay. Bnei Yisrael leave Mitzrayim. Right? Begam tzedolo asulahem. They didn't take provisions. They just left. Yirmiyahu twice in his book, because that's the point of Yirmiyahu. The marriage has gone very bad after all these years. Right? What's the first thing a marriage therapist tries to do when they're married 30 years and they're thinking of breaking up after all this time? What's the most important thing for him to do? Maybe you can find some of the magic you might remember from the early parts of your marriage. Things were more fresh. Now you've gotten bored of each other or right? You're getting annoyed with each other. Why would Bnei Yisrael annoyed with God? Because you don't let us do all those wonderful things that the Gentiles, although the Zara does. You're boring. You don't let us have any sex in the temples. You don't let us have any dancing, any
eye candy for the goddesses and then the priestesses. You don't let us do any fertility rituals. And you're very jealous. You don't let us do anything but you. Right? So Yirmiyahu is, he's trying to bring back the past. He says in chapter 2, does this sound familiar? Zocharti lo chesed ni'urayich avas kulnosayich lechtecha charay bamidbar be'eretz lo zeruah. If this was closer to Rosh Hashanah, you might remember. This is one of the big psukim of Zichronos. Zocharti lo chesed ni'urayich. You hear it? I remember the chesed of your youth. So Rashi on the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu says, what was the chesed of our youth? That we went out into the desert. Gam tzedolo, asulahem. We followed God blindly into the desert. Without asking any questions. Where's the food coming from? Where's the water coming from? Where's the protection from the elements? So God said, I'll take care of you. Just feel comfortable in my hands. That's chapter 2. Chapter 31, Ko Amar Hashem, Motzo Chein Bamidbar. Sound familiar? Am Sridei Chorev Holoch Lahargio Yisrael. Motzo Chein Bamidbar. Did Yirmiyahu read Sefer Bamidbar? Really? Motzo Chein Bamidbar? We were charming in the desert? Yikes. Well, the answer is, we only tested God 10 times in those 40 years. If you were and I were in the desert that long, we would have tested Him 10 times a week. I don't know, maybe. So the point is that the prophet Yirmiyahu, after 800 years, speaks glowingly about this time period. Did this honeymoon last a long time? If it lasted, we should have. How long was it supposed to take for us to get into Israel? 11 days. We were supposed to be in Israel by before the end of Nisan. Right? This is the first problem. We're cornered by the sea. Okay? Now, I must tell you that the rabbis don't really find fault with Bnei Israel here. Okay? I think a little archaeology is at hand now, because the Israelites run out into the desert, right? They don't go the quickest route. Did they know that this wasn't the quickest route? Right? Rashi says, because it was close. No. Rashbam says, even though it was close, they didn't go that way. And they took a circuitous route. And the people might be saying, wait a second, that's the coast. We know the coast goes right up the Mediterranean, right into Israel. What are we doing? Why are we going this way? Okay, but look, God is taking us. We got to follow. Right? Now, here's the thing. I think this came up in an earlier discussion, is that there are three elements of subterfuge in the story of our just before when we're leaving Egypt that fits an amazing ma'aseh avot simon labanim to this past week's parsha. What's the obvious subterfuge on our part with Paro? She's my sister, she's not my wife. Right? Avraham is basically putting his wife in danger, and he's technically not lying because she's his brother's daughter, and his brother's son, Lot, he calls him my brother. Let our shepherds not fight, right? So he can call his brother's daughter, he's married to him, my sister. Fair enough. Okay? This is not a stretch to say that Yiska is Sarah. Yiska means princess in Aramaic, Sarah means princess in Hebrew. Came from Aram Naharaim to the land of the Hebrews, or the crossing over of Shem Bayit to Aver's place, they started speaking Hebrew. Okay? Did God say the words Lech Lecha to Abraham in Aramaic or in Hebrew? I'll leave that for you. Okay? So Abraham, you've heard of this concept, right? Ma'aseh Avot Siman Lebanim. Everything Abraham did in Parshas Lech Lecha has some kind of hint in Sefer Shmos about our trip in Egypt, our time in Egypt. Right? I'm not saying everything in Shmos is in Lech Lecha, but everything in Lech Lecha, chapter 12 and 13, is in Shmos. That we would leave with great wealth, right? Rabban even says, this is further, he says that Paro wanted Sarah for himself. That's why he killed all the boys. Let's get rid of this whole nation. We'll kill the boys and the girls. We'll marry Egyptian men and then there's no more nation. Just like he takes Sarah, he wants to take the girls. You get it? That's Ramban's Chiddush. You get it? That he takes the Masa of Usmin Bonim to actually shed light on things that are not mentioned in Shmos. There's not, no reference that Paro says, we'll kill the boys in order to subjugate them so that we can marry their daughters. Well, that seems obvious, right? Question?
Doesn't Ramban say that Abraham's going down to Egypt was, like, in itself, a sin?
The cause of ETS is right.
It's
like, it sounds like they are in the dark. No, not 100%. If I were to give a shot of this, I would say that had Avraham sweated it out, like Ramban wants him to, and not put his wife in this danger, then when it came time for two generations later, 190 years later, where another patriarch, during time of famine, is tempted to go down to Egypt because his own father wanted to and God told him not to. Talk about Yitzchak now, right? The Parshas Koldos. That when Yaakov, they're hungry. It's easy for us to talk. We ate recently and we're going to eat soon. But they're hungry for a long time. The famine is 2 years long. And he hears that guy who's been giving my sons all this trouble is actually Yosef. He's got a lot of explaining to do, I think. But, okay, I don't know what Yaakov and Yosef talked about. But when he learned that guy is actually Yosef, what made Yaakov think that I should go down to him to get food? Right? Now that we know it's Yosef, we can certainly, for 2 years we've been going down there for food, and we can certainly get food from him. He'll keep us well stocked until this famine is over. I'm sure Yosef has the wherewithal to do that. Why does Yaakov go down to Egypt? Give me the real pashup shot in the Torah. Why does Yaakov go down to Egypt to see Yosef? Let Yosef come up to him when he has a vacation. I know Yosef can't stay up here in Canaan, but okay. But why should I go there? Because I want to spend time with Yosef. It looks to me like the Medrash says, Yaakov spent no time with Yosef in those 17 years. To the point that he didn't recognize Yosef's sons. Right? The Medrash says that Yosef left Yaakov and wouldn't spend any time with him because every second, every livelong second that Yaakov was in Yosef's presence, he tortured him and said, what happened to you that day? Tell me the story. And Yosef wouldn't tell. That was his true. Yaakov, I think, died not knowing what happened. So that when the brothers said later, after Yaakov died, they went to Yosef and they said, our father told us to tell you not to kill us for what we did to you. You know what I'm talking about, right? Remember in Yavamis, the son of Base? That's a lie. Either Yaakov never knew about it. If he had known about it, he wouldn't think that Yosef would be so vindictive as to kill them all. That would pretty much destroy the whole of this whole nation. I mean, it's a big Yaakov. Now you're going to be the patriarch of the nation for killing all your brothers? Right? Now, it might be true that the way Yaakov treats Shimon and Levi for what they did in Shechem, who knows what he would have done to all of them if he had known Yosef was in the position to tell anything Yaakov would have believed. Right? I was calling out from the pit and I said, please, I know you want to kill me, but what are you going to think about Daddy? What are you going to tell Daddy today? And they spit on me and they said, we can't wait to see him suffer forever, all the trouble he's given us. Yosef was in the position to say anything that would have made Yaakov wipe them all out and make Yosef the fourth patriarch. Something they accused him perhaps all along of doing. Avram has many children, only one father. Yitzchak, even Ezra had many children, not just Yaakov and Esav. Those are the only ones we know about. It says, Yishtach Abulucha B'nei Himecha. Your mother's children shall bow down to you. Yitzchak and Rivka had many children, and only one carries on. And Yaakov has many children, and he wants the same thing to happen? To be another patriarch, and we're just going to disappear into oblivion like those guys? We're not going to put up with that. Right? And Yosef could possibly get that if that's what he wanted. But you know what? That may be what he wanted when he was 17.
But now he's older and more mature. He realizes he has to do tshuva also to fix sacred relations. Right? I know I'm all over the world today, but have you ever medrash that asks which tribe gets to have the base of Mikdash in his place? Binyan. Why? Base of Mikdash could not be in any tribe but Binyan. Tell me why.
Only tribe that didn't participate in
Mechiras Yosef. Wait a second. Yosef didn't participate in Mechiras Yosef. Well, yes, he did. Now, it's not fair. Shiloh, which stood 369 years, was in the land of Yosef. So, but he doesn't get the Beis Olamim. He doesn't get the everlasting place. That can only be Binyan. Get it? So it's Rochel's children who get all the big temple. You know, and Shiloh was destroyed. So was Yerushalayim, but Yerushalayim maintains its Kedusha, Shiloh didn't. Right? So get back to the Gemara says that Yosef, that the brothers were lying. Yaakov never knew what happened to him in that story. Okay? You're with me in tangent after tangent here? And Moshe is aware of all this. Of all the struggles of how older and younger brothers are interacting, right? And he right. So the Bnei Yisrael are on their way out of Egypt, right? And they're ready to follow Hashem wherever you take me, right? Okay, you're taking me. The first thing, you're taking me out of the normal derech. Okay, let's finish off the Masa of Sima Levanim. Is that because Avraham used some type of subterfuge that he felt he needed? I don't want to second guess Avraham. It's easy for us to pontificate here in front of our Sfarim, right? Avraham felt the only way I can survive is to do this. But Dak and Rabban say it was sinful. And it's what caused the state in the trap. Because, now here's the point. Had Avraham said, God told me to come here. He told me to come here, and the first thing I see is famine. By the way, what's the second thing he sees? War. It's a war zone. It's 12, four kings and five kings. They rebelled in 12 years, fighting 13 years. Right? You know what I'm saying? Chapter 14. It's a war zone and it's a famine zone. So why does God want me to go now? Because I want you to move the center of civilization from Mesopotamia to the middle, further south. He does. Mesopotamia is it? Don't buy stock in Mesopotamia anymore. It's changing, right? Not going to change. It changes the world. All right. So Avraham comes down and he feels that the only way I can survive this situation is through subterfuge. So you know what? It ends up here too. What's the first subterfuge? Moshe tells Paro we're going for 3 days in the desert. What is Paro here? Coming back. What happens? Be right at the beginning of Bashalach. It says, Vayishma Paro ki barach ha'om. What are you talking about? You didn't just send them? What's this for? Ishma Paro ki barach ha'om. Right? Now, granted, the pasuk does say that God changed his heart around to chase after them. Understand an obvious question? Guys, come on. Hit me. It says, look at pasuk. Pasuk Hey, Vayefech Levav Paro Ba'avadov. Ches, Vayechazek Hashem Eslev Paro. God hardened his heart to chase after Bnei Yisrael. An obvious question, guys. Why did Paro's heart have to be hardened to chase after them? It's a new situation. Right? You know what I'm saying? In other words, I think they're coming home. And then I heard that they continue on into the desert. Right? Rashi says the simple pshat is that he expected them to come back. But, this is now Bravanel's kvetch, he says that convention should have said, you know what, Abroch to Columbus, let them go. I'm not going to chase after them. I don't need this. We're going to manage ourselves.
Yeah. So it was a change of, it required a change of heart from God. What was that change of heart? So I'm firmly with Rashi, one Perush of Rashi in Perek Zion, and Ibn Ezra, who says that Paro's heart was never hardened by God. It never happens. Well, there are all those psukim, I'm going to harden his heart, right? What? No, I will harden his heart and he will not let you go.
Based on what Hashem does, Paro will harden his heart.
Of course, of course. And I love this. There is a scene in the movie The Ten Commandments that I think is such a shot in this Rashi and Ezra. It's where, you know, when Moshe was an Egyptian, there was a love interest. Okay, taboo, you have to have that, right? So the young Charlton Heston has, I forgot the name of the actress, but so she's in love with him. She's mad in love with him. So that when he becomes Moshe with a beard, she's still in love with him. And she makes a play for him, and she says, and she tells him that if you don't do what I say, I'm in a position, or what she first says, right? If you listen to me and do as I say, I am in a position to soften Paro's heart, to go easy on your heel. If you really believe your God is taking you, telling you to do this, I'm with you on this. Right? She even suggests, run away with me and we'll go and live someplace in Ethiopia together. Right? So, which by the way, I could picture Midrash literature about this. You know, he's still married to this Ethiopian princess. But she says, because I'm in the position to soften Ramses' heart, to go easy on your Hebrews. And then when she sees he's not listening, and she says, I'm also in a position to harden his heart. So he looks into her eyes and he says, you may be the lovely dust whereby God puts forth his plan. You know what I'm saying? You know how that works? Hashem doesn't fret with anybody's free will. That's the rule. Rule number one. The rule number two is that God can change the rules, but you get the point, right? Is that Ibn Ezra and Rashi say that no free will was ever in. Even all those psukim in Sefer Yehoshua, right, where it says God hardened the heart of the 30 nations and 31 nations and the whole Middle East, but the Yeruvim. It's all, you know what I'm saying? It's all just the workings. Did God harden Saddam Hussein's heart in 1991 not to give up those two islands back to Kuwait? And he could have kept all so much other stuff that he took? We knew it wasn't going to change. And it was Parshas Va'era that the deadline was. So all rabbis in the world were talking about, you know, Saddam Hussein acting like Paro. January 15th, 1992. Which was Rosh Chodesh. So I went up when Bush the First gave that date a month in advance. I looked at the date and I said, oh, it's because America has this reconnaissance. Now everyone has it, but it was this like night vision stuff that other nations didn't have. It was Rosh Chodesh, and it's dark, a darker night, so it makes sense. Okay? Lamaisa, but Paro really thought that they're coming back. All right? But it was some kind of change of heart. What is that change of heart? 2 and 3. Anybody can? They have our stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right? Now, you and I can pontificate and say, V'yishalu ish me'ez re'eu, v'yisha me'ez re'usa. That doesn't necessarily mean borrow. Right? Sha'al in the Bible does sometimes refer to ask for something to keep. Okay, you know, Shomer Shoel, you know what that is, if I would say, right? When you borrow something, that hurt the you expect me to give it back to you, no? You borrow your car? I'm keeping it. That's crazy. Right? Alright, so now it could be that it's also revenge for the firstborn, right? They're smarting from all that. You know, that's could be also what could make Paro, after all they had seen, these 10 plagues, especially the last one, how could he possibly convince them? You're Paro. Isn't it time for a rebellion already? Right? All right, but the real kicker, this is a Medrash, and the movie picks up on it, is that when Paro sees where Bnei Yisrael went, looks at them from far, says, their God is not a good general. He took them into a dead end. And it's been my focus in the scholars where Kriyas Yam Suf actually was. But I'll table that for the moment. But they went into a thin, let's say, Bein Migdol, and Migdol is in North Africa. There's like this thin little strip of land. It's like an island. And it doesn't make its way. It ends like here, and it doesn't make its way back to the shore. What could cause such a thing? An earthquake or something else? But you know what I'm saying? It's this little thin strip of land that goes about 5 miles off the coast, and they went in there. The power says this. How does their God, who just did all that stuff, not know that they're sitting ducks? We're going to push them all into the sea after we take our stuff back. Right? Now you see how this hardens Paro's heart, guys? So Avraham deals in subterfuge. So did we. You feel bad for the Egyptians? Rashi, you know what Rashi says on this? He goes, tough luck. You guys were so evil. Don't come crying. It's not fair. You got our stuff. This might explain why Abraham in chapter 14 says, no one will ever say that the king of Sidon made me rich. That he didn't mind people saying the king of Egypt made you rich. Explain.
Sidon was worse. He didn't want
along the lines of what we're saying here.
Well, he deserved the stuff from Egypt.
And. So that when my descendants leave this place, they will also leave with this wealth. Myself is similar upon him. Don't you get it? Okay. This goes along with the Ramban, who says that God told Abraham, say, go forge out a path, because everything you do will bear ominously. I don't mean that in a negative way. It would be an omen to these things. Okay? It's ironic, though. You don't always get to see it. Okay? If Adam says, Adam pushes off guilt when he hears the word Ayeka, don't be surprised if his son pushes off guilt when he hears Ehev Elohecha. Because Hevel heard that kind of talk at the kitchen table when they're eating together. You know what I'm saying? Is that children ironically tend to nothing's a fast refer or fast rule here, but alright, so when they're leaving Egypt, It gels together with Lech Lecha. With me? Right? So when Yaakov hears that it's his son, right? And he sent wagons and Cadillacs for him, and he said, look at the wagons that I sent you down in. So he realized that something is going on here. Why did he go down to Egypt? Why didn't he just say, I'm not leaving this place? So give me the Pasuk's answer, and give me, you know, what I want to hear. Pasuk's answer is because God told him to. God said, go down to Egypt. I'll be with you there. This is the beginning of that stuff that your grandfather spoke to you about, no doubt. Right? But if I was to give a hashkafe reason why Yaakov goes down, it's because Abraham did. Had Abraham said, I'm not leaving this place, then Yaakov would have said the same thing. This was my puny little interpreter telling me what God was supposed to do. God, according to this Mahalach, Ramban, God would have told Abraham, Yaakov, you know, your grandfather stuck it out. I told your father not to leave, and you stay here, because you're going to be a great nation in this place, and I want you to stay here. That's not the way it was. Okay? One last thing. How does a Bravanel think he can get away with saying in his Haggadah that the Shibud Mitzrayim was a punishment for Mechiras Yosef? I
can understand how what we experienced in trying to be a kapara for it, Michilas Yosef. You know what I mean? Right? But how do you think you can get away with telling us that Yetzias Mitzrayim is a punishment for Michilas Yosef?
I hope you can get the sophistication of what I'm about to say. The same way that Abravanel thinks he can get away with saying that that David couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash because of what he did with Bathsheba. What's the problem with saying that?
That's
and you just said Tanakh? No. Divrei HaYomim gives a different reason. Shmuel Bet, when David asks to build the Beis HaMikdash, doesn't give a reason at all. In fact, the prophet tells him, yes, David, this is a good idea. You should do this. Start working out in the morning, and we'll put together the plans. And then Nasan has the unfortunate task of coming to him in the morning and telling him without giving him a reason. And David doesn't ask for a reason. But what's the real philosophical problem with saying that he couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash because of Bathsheba? The same philosophical reason of saying that Yetzias Mitzrayim happened, that Shibud Mitzrayim happened because of Mechiras Yosef. What's the philosophical problem of both of these?
Oh, you can't punish the children. It's not.
When God told David, "You can't build the Beis HaMikdash for me," he hadn't yet not yet sinned with Bathsheba. Right? And how can you say that Shibud Mitzrayim was because of Mechiras Yosef when God tells Avram about Shibud Mitzrayim and Yosef hasn't been born yet? Right, this is a deep philosophical notion. For God, time is fluid. God knows what David is going to do with Bathsheba, but he does have the freedom of choice when he saw Bathsheba bathing to rush off the roof, go into his own house, and take care of whatever Yetzirah had at that moment, which was hopefully still a noreach or a heilach, if you know Sukkah Daf Nun Beis. If he chooses to exercise his free will to do that, then Nasan the next morning is going to come to David and say, "David, I have good news for you." Okay. Nothing is set in stone, but God does know what's going to happen, and Abravanel does. These two fit; they're the same. Abravanel's chiddush in how David could be denied building the Beis HaMikdash because of something he hasn't done yet is an amazing, amazing kind of commentary. Right? I'll leave that for now, and get back to Shmos Perek Yudal Pasuk Yud. Uparo hikriv. Power is drawing close. Right? And the people see this. They're trapped. They can see what's on their right and their left. They don't know what's in front of them. But if they did, they'd really be screaming. Okay? This fits beautifully. You ever learned Maseches Arachin? The end of the first parak?
I did the second parak. That Maseches Arachin says that Kriyas Yam Suf was like this rainbow. It wasn't like they got up to 181st Street and the highway, and they're, "Oh, there's water in front of us. The right way, what are we going to do?" Well, you can go this way, or you can just go straight through the water to the other side, right? And they'll get stuck on it. No, that's not the way it was. It was into the water like this, and then back to the same side. Tomorrow, take a look at Dav Tes Zayin in the Maseches Arachin. You'll see a picture, and Rashi draws the picture. The printed editions has this picture. Okay, it mamish fits. This I'm telling you now. I admit there are different opinions about what Kriyas Yamsuf was. This is the opinion of Atlas Karta. You heard of it? Atlas Karta. Could you be 4 years or 3 years of YU and not know what Atlas Karta is? Come on, you never had Dr. Orly? I was here in the 70s. Dr. Orly used to come up with his big maps and his, you know what I'm talking about? He's retired last year. So, yeah, but I had him in the 70s. So Atlas Karta is a Musada Rav Kook has, and now it's much updated since then, but it's
maps of relevant stories in Tanakh, starting with Bereishis and going straight through all of Tanakh.
Tell you where the desert dwelling was, where the Eidom happened, where was our Sinai. It tells you all these various things.
You have some of them in the Stone of Chumash here, but Atlas Karta's is hundreds of pages of this, right? So Atlas Karta's opinion is that this is how Pirkei Yamtzev was, and in understandably, Chazal don't find anything wrong with the way people talk here. Okay, it's pretty harsh. I will tell you. It says, "Vayitzaku." Listen to what Moshe is listening to. "Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael al Hashem," not to Moshe, but to God. Fair enough. He's supposed to cry out to God. That was Moshe's undoing with the rock in Parshas Chukas, right? He had a chance to teach them. What do you do when you're thirsty? When you're going to this new land, you learn Maseches Tainus and you have a fast day and you call out and you scream, right? Instead, I hit the rock again, like I did 40 years earlier. Direct punishment is not to get into that place where they're going to, you know, need to scream, because they don't get automatic water like you did in Egypt, where you just move your feet and the water spreads. Here you got to look up to me and beg for the rain from upstairs. Are there not enough graves to bury us? Wow, that's pretty harsh. Right? But you know, this is the first time around. Halozer the bar shod yibanu elach v'mitzrayim demor chadal mimenu v'navdos mitzrayim kitov lanu avodis mitzrayim imusein v'bidbar. Whoa, here is a hint that the honeymoon didn't last too long at all. While they were still in Egypt, they said, I don't know, Rashi, what about this pasuk? This pasuk indicates that is this the sentiment of everybody? This sentiment means that they doubted that this could work. You following? What you know? Who would choose continued slavery? Right? Well, you would choose continued slavery if you thought the alternative was to die a gruesome death in the desert, right? Okay, but Moshe just says, you know, what you're saying is disgusting. How dare you, right? No, okay. This look, it's so extreme. By this time, maybe they've sized up what's going on with them, right? How could God take us into such a... Guys, don't question God's plan. This is part of God's plan. And you will survive. You know, it's interesting. Chazal say that the experience at Kriyas Yamsuf was greater in terms of getting close to Hashem than even Har Sinai. It's pretty amazing. You ever hear this? What every handmaiden saw at Kriyas Yamsuf, even Yecheskel didn't see. In the Masa Merkava. Why do you say Kriyas Yamsuf? Say Matan Torah. And the Haggadah, at the end of the Haggadah, makes this point, or seems to make this point also. Not the end, at the end of Magid. Right? I mean, look, I got to tell you, Yehoshua, in Sefer Yehoshua, in Perek Daled, when 36 people at Ai are killed, and he says, God, why did you take us out of Egypt for? Why did you make us cross the Yarden? It would have been better for us to just be on the other side of the Yarden and just spend our time there than to come in Israel and lose soldiers. So that's chutzpah. But Yehoshua sort of cleanses it at the end by saying, "Umati yeh b'shimcha agadol." What's going to be of your great name? Right? I don't see a similar statement here from Bnei Yisrael. They're not sophisticated enough like Yehoshua is to say such a thing. But Yehoshua's last statement sort of koshers his chutzpah. Right? I don't know if you Bnei Yisrael have that sentiment here. Alright? But what I want to concentrate at the beginning of next class on Thursday, and this I'm going to tell you such an amazing chiddush next class. But I want you to read what I consider to be one of the most difficult, short little snippets in the whole Tanakh. read it to you now. It's the beginning of Melachim Bet. I want you to look up these psukim. And I'm going to use this very difficult story. It's an amazingly difficult story. And because both stories involve thirst. And Israel thirsting for water at the end of Melachim Bet, Perek Bet. The water was poisonous. The water was killing people. So what does Elisha do? He takes some salt, throws it in the water, and he says, "Drink." Amazing. You've heard of Elisha, right? He's the most beloved of all prophets. He just goes around Israel to perform miracles for everyone. And after performing this miracle, you know what I'm getting to? Listen to what it says. "V'yal mishom beit el, v'hu ole b'derech, u'narim k'tanim yatzu min ha'ir." And he went out from there after performing his great miracle, saving all these lives. "Some young children left the city by Kalsuba, and they cursed him. Vayamulo,
you're bald.
Alei Kerik. Go up, bald one. Go up, bald one." V'yifan acharav, he looked at them. V'yareim, he looked at them and he said, "V'yikalein b'shem Hashem." He cursed them in the name of Hashem. Not something the rabbis usually like when people do. V'teitzena shtayim dubim yediyah. Two bears emerged from a non-existent forest. There's no forest here in hell. But v'kama mehem arba'im u'shnei yeladim. Ripped apart 42 children. V'yelch misham el har ha-kamel, misham shav shomar. Then he went to Har HaKarmel, which is strange because Har HaKarmel is way up north, and then back to Shomron. There's something to do with that, but I'm not going to concentrate. What is this story? What's going on? This is the beloved Elisha? And why did the Tanakh include it? Every single thing Elisha did is included in the Tanakh. What I want you to do is, it's begin the end of Melachim Bet, Perek Bet. We are going to start next class with the thirst and the hunger in chapter 15 and 16. Thirst and hunger, that's what our objective is next class, okay, on Thursday. And I'm going to tie that into what Chazal say about this extremely bizarre story. And we'll try to do that next class, okay? All right, everyone, have a great day. Just hit that. Yep.